shenanigans. Another woman claims she's engaged to Tsvangirai and that he's promised to marry her. Ofer Bjerkestad-Stockton, NPR News, Johannesburg.
Republican presidential nominee Mitt Romney is criticizing President Obama today for not planning to meet with the Prime Minister of Israel, calling it, quote, confusing and troubling that he would not meet with a close ally of the U.S. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is due to speak at the U.N. next week. Industrial production suffering another setback. The Federal Reserve is reporting a 1.2% decline in August, largest amount in 3 years. Manufacturing output, the most critical part of industrial production, fell 0.7%. Dow is up 41 points. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from American Jewish World Service, pursuing global justice through grassroots change at ajws.org.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. Season 3 of the HBO series Boardwalk Empire begins Sunday, and one of the standout characters is Federal Agent Nelson Van Alden, played by our guest Michael Shannon. Shannon also starred last year in the movie Take Shelter as a husband and father who starts having visions about an apocalyptic storm and doesn't know if it's prophecy or a sign of mental illness. In 2009, Shannon received an Oscar nomination for his role in Revolutionary Road. Boardwalk Empire set in Atlantic City during Prohibition. Shannon's a Prohibition agent with the Department of Internal Revenue, an inhibited man and devout Christian surrounded by a world of crime and sinful temptation. He eventually succumbs, drinking liquor, having extramarital sex, and committing a horrific act that would change his life. Terry interviewed Michael Shannon last fall during the second season of Boardwalk Empire.
I'd like to play what might be your most talked about scene. This is the scene in which you insist on baptizing your partner, Agent Sepso, in the river, and he doesn't want to be baptized because he's Jewish. Now, you correctly suspect that he's been on the take to Nucky Thompson, the boss of the liquor operation in Atlantic City during Prohibition. So in this scene, you've brought him to a spot on the river where a local African-American church conducts baptisms, and the preacher who is in the water performing baptisms as you arrive. He sees you and speaks first.
Agent Van Alden of the Bureau of Internal Revenue, have you come here to be accepted into the arms of Christ?
I have never left him, Deacon. Though I have at times turned from his love.
You cannot turn from him, sir. Whatsoever the compass point, he's there beside you.
I do know that to be so. But this man does not. There is a veil over his eyes, Deacon, and a darkness in his soul.
Come forward.
No, thank you.
Young sir, come forward.
No, thank you.
Come forward, Mr. Sepso.
I'd really rather not.
You insult these good people and their beliefs?
They're not my beliefs.
What are you afraid of, Mr. Sepso?
I'm not afraid.
Then let these waters wash you clean. Yes.
So you finally get Agent Sepso, who again is Jewish, into the water, and you have the pastor's permission to baptize him. You keep dunking his head underwater, and he keeps declining to be baptized. And in your zeal to baptize him, you keep his head underwater so long you end up drowning him. So let's hear that part of the scene. And then this part of the scene, the pastor is getting worried that you're hurting Agent Sepso, and he tries to intervene, but you keep on dunking him until you kill him. The pastor speaks first.
This is not a battle, sir.
You're wrong, Deacon. It is a battle against the devil himself. I have seen him abroad in the daylight and the night, and by God, I will force him out. Thou hast fulfilled the judgment of the wicked!
Wow, you just killed this guy, and you're praising God that thou hast fulfilled the judgment of the wicked. You say about this agent who you've just killed that there's a darkness in his soul, and of course that really describes your character. There is a real darkness in your soul.
Yes, well, I think with Van Alden, probably like most people, His problems began in childhood. I imagine him coming from a very strict background, probably not a very compassionate background. I imagine his father being somewhat of an ogre and maybe even, you know, physically abusing him from time to time. And so that's kind of the seed of what grows into the adult Van Alden. But I think he's a very sad character because I do believe he ultimately has good intentions and he wants to do the right thing. And he goes to Atlantic City believing that he can do some good in the world. And as many nefarious activities as he gets up to, he's also surrounded by people thwarting him at every turn. So that act of drowning Sepso is the culmination of a great deal of frustration and despair on his part.
Have you known anybody who is as much, you know, a zealot and delusional at the same time as the agent who you portray is?
You know, I've known a lot of very religious people. My mother is very religious, but she was also very is very private about it. She when I was growing up, she never went to church. She just prayed and read her Bible and kept it to herself. So I'm not from a background of flamboyant believers. It's much more a personal issue. But it's very important to me not to judge Van Alden or to judge people in general. When you're an actor, it can be a hindrance, I think, if you look askance at people, you know.
At the same time, though, you've tried to create a backstory for him so you can understand what he's been through that shaped him. And you were telling us, for instance, that you assume his father might have abused him when he was young, and he abuses himself. There's a scene in the first season where, because he feels sexually attracted to somebody who he should not, she's not his wife, you very carefully lay out, like a towel on the bed, you carefully lay out your belt over the towel, and then you take off your shirt, and then you lift the belt and knot it, and then start flagellating yourself.
Right.
And it's like such a surprise, like you're not, you know, like you're not prepared. I mean, the viewer is not prepared for that. But is that one of the reasons why you assume that the agent's father beat him when the agent was a child, and now he beats himself?
Yes, I think this behavior he probably learned from his father. Maybe his father practiced it as well. But I think one of the things that's so striking about the scene, like you say, is that it's very ritualistic, and it's not it's not histrionic, you know, or hysterical. It's very methodical.
Mm-hmm.
And that, to me, is one of the fascinating things about Van Alden's journey, is seeing him not only lose control of maybe his reason or his perspective, but I think along the way he loses control of that methodic, ritualistic sense of himself. To me, it's much more horrifying to actually see Van Alden take a drink than it is to see him whip himself with the belt, because the drink is something that Van Alden has told himself his whole life that he would never, ever do under any circumstances. So for me, playing the part, it was actually a lot more difficult to show up and do the scene where he walks into a speakeasy and has a shot of whiskey and then goes over and talks to Lucy than it was to do the flagellation scene.
And you understand this character so well. You've thought him through so carefully. It seems to me you should be, like, writing your part. Do you have any input into the writing of it?
I haven't tried to exercise it, put it that way. There are certain people on the show that I think do a great deal of research and from time to time get to go up to the writer's room, and make a pitch for this or that. But I enjoy seeing where the writer's imaginations take this character. So I trust them.
You're very tall. How tall are you?
I'm 6'4".
And you use your size in some of your roles in a very imposing way, like in Boardwalk Empire. And in Boardwalk Empire, you are so like tall and imposing, yet so disconnected from your body. I mean, the body is a source of sin and temptation. There's almost something Frankensteinish right. about it, in the sense that like Frankenstein is a brain inside this body that the brain doesn't belong in. So like the body just doesn't know how to move. The body is so stiff and kind of rigid, and like that's what your body is. You are so out of touch with it.
Well, I think that's another thing, another aspect of Van Alden that probably germinated in his childhood. I imagine that he was always told not to slouch, to sit up straight, and to have good posture. And I think it is a Frankenstein scenario in a way, because I think inside of Van Alden is a child, that arrested child that never really got to develop its own identity. I think as much as he believes that he's operating from these deeply held beliefs, he's actually, in a way, very hollow. I don't think he has even begun to really explore who he really is. So I think that is very exciting for the trajectory of the character, because, I mean, you can already see that he's really painting himself into a corner. He's going to have to reinvent himself.
Michael Shannon speaking with Terry Gross. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air.
Programs on WILL are made possible by Jim Rue at Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, offering pinch-proof doors, keyless digital entries, and lifetime manufacturer warranties on many products. Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families with professionally installed doors and automatic openers since 1959. 367-8121.
We're listening to Terry's interview recorded last fall with Michael Shannon, who plays Federal Agent Nelson Van Alden in the HBO series Boardwalk Empire. Its third season, premiere Sunday.
In Take Shelter, you play a husband and the father of a young girl who's deaf and needs surgery and lessons in American Sign Language. You lose your job during the course of the movie, so things are rough. But throughout the movie, you're having these nightmares and hallucinations of menacing cloud formations. And in the sky, you see hundreds of birds in very disturbing formations. It starts to rain in these nightmares, and the rain is almost like rust-colored. It's like a yellowish brown. And you don't know whether this is some kind of premonition that you're having, if this is some kind of like prophecy that will be fulfilled, or if you're losing your mind and you're afraid that you are entering a stage of mental illness because your mother was diagnosed with schizophrenia when she was in her 30s, which is the approximate age that you are now. So right. let me just play a scene from this. At this point, you've decided to seek psychological help. So you go to a counselor who's played by Lisa Gay Hamilton. She speaks first.
I'm going to start by asking you some questions.
Okay. I already answered all the questions on the form.
Yeah, I know I looked at them, but I need to get a profile started on you.
Right. Well, out of the five possible symptoms needed to be diagnosed with schizophrenia, delusions, hallucinations, disorganized speech, disorganized behavior, and the negative symptoms, I've had two. Delusions and hallucinations. So I took this quiz in the back of the book. I scored a 5 out of a possible 20. Schizophrenia starts at 12. So they say it might be a brief psychotic disorder. Yeah, whatever it is, I need to know what to do or what to get on to get this thing under control.
You are in a constant state of anxiety in this movie because you're always expecting the apocalypse.
Right.
And you're always imagining the worst-case scenario and needing to protect your family from it. Were you in a constant state of anxiety making the movie?
No, I wouldn't say that. I actually really enjoyed working on the film. I really enjoyed the people I was working with a lot. And for me, it was easy because it just made sense to me. The movie made sense. And I think even though in the film, with these nightmares and these visions, they're obviously exaggerated beyond what most people experience. But I do think they're reflective of a general feeling that people can relate to, or a percentage of people can probably relate to, of just feeling frightened and powerless and wondering what the heck's going to happen next.
Do you dream a lot?
I go through periods where I dream a lot and then periods where I don't. Oddly enough, when I'm working, I don't tend to dream very much. I guess because what I'm doing during the day has a kind of a dreamlike quality to it that it's very different than if I went to an office and filed data all day long, then I'd probably want to go home and have a, you know, rich life in my dreams. But, you know, my life is so surreal. You know, making films is a very surreal business, you know.
I just want to say something about your face. We talked a little bit about your height earlier. A couple of distinctive things about your face is that you have very full lips, and they're often, like, depending on the role, like, when there's a lot of tension in your face or pain or inwardness, they tend to, like, really turn down your lips, you know, like, turn down with the expression of tension. And I never know whether you're thinking about that or whether you're just thinking the emotion and that's what happens.
Oh, gee. Well, you can get into pretty dicey territory there.
With trying to, like, move your lips or something?
Yeah, if you're just trying to manipulate. It's a very delicate thing because film and television, it's photography. This is going to sound kind of ridiculous, but in a way you're kind of modeling a story. You know, you have to be conscious of the fact that it's being photographed, whereas in theater you really are just trying to get to the heart of the matter. You know, I've had experiences on film where I really felt what was happening, and I felt like it couldn't be any more perfect than what it was. It just seemed like exactly what it needed to be. And then I've seen it, and it's completely the opposite of what I thought, or you don't see anything. I had this experience recently where I was working on something and doing a take and over and over, and I talked to the director, and he'd say, well, what about this or what about that? And I said, oh, okay. And then finally I just did a take where I kind of turned my head a slightly different angle, and it worked. And he was like, oh, that's perfect. I was like, all I did was I just turned my head a little bit. He's like, well, trust me, it's exactly what I wanted. So we'd been having all these, you know, high-minded conversations about what my character was thinking or what he wanted. And really all I needed to do was, you know, turn my head 45 degrees. But by and large, to your original question, I'm trying not to think about that aspect of it. I still try to focus just on what my character's trying to do.
So you've played so many eccentric characters, bordering some of them on crazy. Do you think of yourself as eccentric?
I guess I do. Partially, it's just the life of an actor. It's an unusual life. It's hard, you know, if you walk downtown past all the people with, you know, their briefcases and going about their daily routine, that it's hard to feel like a member of that society, I guess. I feel like I'm settling down. I had a very long period where I led this kind of gypsy-like existence, traveling a lot, not really putting roots down anywhere. But now I'm starting a family and settling down. That's also, my life is a little less, I used to not have much money and it was hard to get by sometimes, and now I have a little bit more comfort and security in that department. But I think more than anything, what it is I'm just very incredibly sensitive person. I think most actors are, you know. I'm very sensitive to what goes on around me, and I'm very, I feel like I'm always kind of paying attention to everything. Like I don't have blinders, or I don't have a lot of maybe defense mechanisms that other people have. I'm very, you know, you're supposed to be very present if you're an actor, and I feel like I am.
At the same time, when you're an actor, you're facing so much rejection and not getting roles and getting bad reviews. Not that you've gotten bad reviews, but I mean, like, what actor doesn't have to face that? So, like, the sensitivity can be a real problem.
Yeah, I've dealt with a lot of that, you know. I think with anybody you see who makes it to the, I don't know, this level of the public eye, you know, it's easy to forget that everybody, even the famous people, put up with a lot of rejection, you know. There's a lot of parts I haven't gotten, and I have gotten a lot of bad reviews. You know, right when I started in Chicago, the first play I got cast in outside of, you know, an academic environment, I was fired from. Yeah, it was a little tiny storefront theater in Chicago, you know, folding chairs and clamp lights, the whole nine yards, and it was called, I think it was called West Bank Story. And I rehearsed for a couple of weeks, and then one day the director walked up to me and said, you know, you have a lot of raw talent, but you should go to the conservatory or something and learn some technique because you're just too, we can't figure out how to get you to do what we want you to do. And so I gave her the finger and left. And,
did you go to the conservatory?
No, I didn't go to the conservatory. I went and did some electrical work, laying cables in a theater. And then a few months later, I went back and gave it another shot. And the rest is history.
Right. Okay. It's been great to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Terry.
Michael Shannon speaking with Terry Gross, recorded last fall. Shannon plays federal agent Nelson Van Alden in the HBO series Boardwalk Empire. Its third season premieres Sunday. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from American Recordings, presenting The Carpenter, the new album from the Avett Brothers featuring Live and Die, available now at Starbucks. From Angie's List, with reviews on local contractors and doctors in 500 categories with ratings based only on member feedback, angieslist.com. And from Subaru, where all vehicles are built in zero landfill plants. Love, it's what makes a Subaru a Subaru. This is NPR.
Where did the universe come from? Is there life on other worlds? How will climate change affect my future? And what happens in your brain that lets you hear and understand my words right now? Hi, I'm Ira Flatow. Join me each week on Science Friday as we tackle big questions in science and let you talk to the researchers studying them. That's on Science Friday from NPR, Fridays at 1 p.m. on WILL-AM 580.
It's tough to be in two places at once, but reporters for The World go to hundreds of places.
For The World, I'm Ursula Lindsay in Cairo.
For The World, I'm Matthew Bell, Gaza City.
And I'm Lisa Mullins in Boston. PRI's The World brings you a global perspective on the news with a worldwide network of correspondents.
In Rabat, Morocco.
Lahore, Pakistan.
Beirut. Istanbul.
In Baghdad.
Listen to The World.
Weekday afternoons at 3 on AM 580.
WILL programs are made possible by Hendrick House at Green and Lincoln, three blocks from the Engineering Quad. Hendrick House rooms are large, carpeted, and air-conditioned with semi-private baths. Meals are served in its Gold LEED certified dining area. More information is available at hendrickhouse.com.
AM 580 brings the world to you every day.
Thanks for listening, and consider supporting us financially to keep this service vibrant and available for everyone.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. Chico and Rita, the Oscar-nominated animated musical, will be out on DVD next week. It's a love story set in Havana, New York, Hollywood, and Paris, largely in the late 40s and early 50s, with great jazz and Cuban music and dazzling animation. Our guest is Spanish director Fernando Trueba, who co-directed Chico and Rita with animator Javier Mariscal. Terry spoke to him in April. Trueba won an Oscar for his film Bella Puck. He also directed the music documentary Calle 54, which featured pianist and composer Bebo Valdez. Valdez composed the score for Chico and Rita and played most of the piano parts. And he was the inspiration for the character of Chico, a Cuban jazz pianist and arranger whose music is considered passé after the revolution. Before the revolution, he falls in love with Rita, a beautiful singer. This is the song she sings when he first sees her.
Bésame, bésame mucho, como si fuera esta noche la última vez. Quiero tenerte muy cerca.
That's Idania Valdez, along with Bebo Valdez, no relation, doing Bésame Mucho from the soundtrack of Chico and Rita. And my guest is the director and co-writer of the film, Fernando Trueba. Welcome to Fresh Air. I love your movie, so thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
You clearly love Cuban music. You love Latin music. You've already done a documentary film about it. What was your idea of how to integrate that music that you love with a story?
Well, I love Cuban music, but you know what I love most of anything in music is jazz, American jazz most of the time. I arrived to Cuban music through jazz. And then when we start talking about the idea of making that movie in Cuba, music, so I say to Mariscal, I say, well, let's do a story that the characters are musicians because I love this ambience and all that. And because I had worked so much with Bebo, and Bebo, who was at the time we did the movie, he was 90. And I had produced records with him, and we thought, why don't we do the character a pianist so we can have Bebo playing in the movie? Bebo, who is the greatest Cuban musician alive today in the world.
He's really amazing. And it's so wonderful to hear his music in the context of a movie. And as you say, he's in his 90s now. And this you say, was his last work. Is he not capable of playing anymore?
Yeah. At the time of the movie, he had already stopped doing concerts because, and he loved playing. He's always playing, but he realized that his memory and health. That he told to me, "I'm not gonna play anymore in public, but I will keep playing at home because I need to play." And his health was very delicate at the time, but he could make it and he could do all the job in the movie. So it's his last work, and that's why the movie is dedicated to him, because not only because of the music, but because I'm sure that if it was not for my friendship with him, I would never have written and make a movie like this one.
So I want to play another song that Bebo Valdez wrote for your film Chico and Rita. And this is the song that Chico is writing when he's separated from Rita and she's become a movie star in Hollywood and he's living in Paris. Their relationship is very on again, off again, and they're always inadvertently doing things to end this relationship that really should be but never lasts for long because of how they keep tripping each other up. So he's longing for her in Paris, and as he's writing this song, he titles it Rita, because she is his muse. She is what's inspiring the song. And then he scratches that out, and he retitles it Lily, naming it after the dog who sits by him loyally at the piano as he composes. So there's different versions of the song. One of them in the movie is sung by Freddie Cole, and I think it's supposed to be Nat King Cole, because Nat Cole did a Latin album. And actually, Nat Cole recorded with Bebo Valdez at some point, didn't he?
Yeah, Nat King Cole records in Espanol, in Spanish, were recorded in Cuba. And Bebo was the pianist in the band.
Oh, so he's the pianist on Nat Cole Espanol?
Yeah, who was the number one best-selling in Nat King Cole career. And Bebo was an admirer of Nat King Cole pianist, because Nat King Cole became very famous as a singer, but not only Bebo, Bill Evans, every time someone asked him who was his favorite pianist, he would say Nat Cole. And he had an enormous influence in some great musicians like Bebo, Bill Evans, and many, many others. Bebo told me that at the time of that recording, Nat King Cole didn't speak one word of Spanish. And Bebo not only had to play piano in the record, but was his coach for Spanish. So he has to teach him to pronounce correctly the words of the song. And Bebo says he did pretty well, only the T's and the O's, he didn't master them very well. That's why he say cachiro, cachiro, instead of saying cachito. And there is a beautiful photograph of Bebo with Sarah Vaughan and Nat King Cole in Tropicana at that time in Havana.
Was Sarah Vaughan?
Sarah Vaughan. Yeah, my American friends are desperate with me because for years I've been saying DC Gillespie instead of Gillespie. And I do this kind of mistakes all the time.
Oh,
sorry.
That's great. So I'm going to ask you about a pronunciation. The singer on this version of Lily that we're going to hear is Estrella Morente. Am I saying that right?
Estrella.
Estrella.
Yeah, Estrella, who means a star. Estrella Morente is, for me, the greatest flamenco singer today. She's 30 years old, and she's the daughter of the greatest Enrique Morente, who passed 1 year ago, who was our best, the master of flamenco singers. And she's an amazing artist.
So let's hear this version of Lily by Bebo Valdez from the film Chico and Rita, featuring Bebo Valdez at the piano and Estrella Morente singing.
Hoy sueño que te amo como ayer, aroma de dulce renací, vuelo del alma que añora momento divino, eco de un beso que implora por nuestro destino. Quizá volverá como ayer, y anhelo de nuevo tener tu querer. Será como un carnaval de infinito placer sin igual, siempre junto los dos, vida. Tuya como ayer.
Bueno,
music from Chico and Rita. We'll hear more of Terry's interview with director Fernando Trueba after a short break. This is Fresh Air.
From 1968 to 2001, Fred Rogers welcomed children on public television to his neighborhood. Many PBS stations, including WILL-TV, still air old episodes of Mr. Rogers. Now Fred Rogers' legacy continues in a new animated series featuring the character of Daniel Tiger.
Let's make believe that we're teeny tiny ants on
Daniel Tiger's Neighborhood, a part of the PBS Kids lineup, weekdays at 10 a.m. and 12:30 p.m. on WILL-TV.
We're listening to Terry's interview recorded in April with Fernando Trueba, who co-directed the animated musical Chico and Rita. It's out on DVD next week.
Was it in some ways easier to do a realistic film about Cuba before the revolution and do it as an animated film than it would have been to shoot on location in Cuba?
I never thought of this story. This story starts as an animation movie. And I never thought, not for one second, as a live-action movie. And it's my first and only animation movie. I have always done live-action movies with actors or some documentaries too. But some kind of stories and situations are best for animation than for live-action or documentary or other kind of language. So that's very curious. For example, most of the time when I see biopic movies, I don't believe, even if there are incredible actors or very good actors, I never believe in biopics.
These are biopics, biographical movies.
Biopics,
usually of famous people. And yes, as you say, information is usually all wrong and you don't believe it.
Yeah, I saw the movie about Margaret Thatcher, and Meryl Streep for me is one of the greatest actresses in the world. But when you watch that movie, you think I'm watching Meryl Streep playing Margaret Thatcher. You don't get lost for one second because you know Margaret Thatcher. Yeah? You can have Anthony Hopkins, who is one of the greatest actors ever, playing Picasso. I will never, one frame, one second of the movie, thought I'm watching Picasso. I'm watching the great Anthony Hopkins pretending to be Picasso. But when you do an animation and you draw Charlie Parker, is Charlie Parker. You know, I can't explain it, but for me at least, it's like that.
I had the same feeling watching the film. There's scenes in New York where, at this club, it's like Thelonious Monk is at the piano, Charlie Parker's playing, the scene with like Ben Webster playing saxophone.
Yeah.
And if you saw a real actor, you'd think, well, he doesn't quite look like Parker, and I wonder who's dubbing for him. When you see it in an animation, it's like, great, yeah, he managed to work in Parker and Monk and Webster. And you just don't question it because the whole thing is animation. You're not measuring it against reality in the same that you do when an actor's playing it. Now, Bebo Valdez left Cuba in 1960, shortly after the revolution. And, one of the points your film makes, which is a point that the documentary Buena Vista Social Club made about Cuban jazz musicians after the revolution, is that their music was considered not revolutionary, passé, not pertinent anymore.
And worse than that, it was considered American, imperialistic.
Therefore counter-revolutionary.
Yeah, and that's one of the things. Every time you ask Bebo his favorite composers, he will say Jerome Kern, Gershwin, Cole Porter. He was in love with American music. And then when they told him, you can't play that anymore, and at that first years, it was really anti-American. It changed a bit later, at least in musical terms I'm talking. But for Bebo, how that I can't play Gershwin? Why? He couldn't understand that. And also, he, as a composer, he was with American BMI for his author rights, no?
The music publishing company.
Yeah, the publishing company. And they say to him, now you can have your publishing company in America. Now the publishing belongs to Cuban state.
So he couldn't collect royalties anymore?
Yeah. So for Bebo, all these things were unacceptable. He didn't want to live in a country with no freedom. So he left as soon as he can.
Yeah, and my understanding is he asked for permission to take his band to Mexico.
He went there because he had an audience in Mexico, but then the unions in Mexico were at the time very pro-Castro. So they boycotted him, the concert, and with tears in his eyes, with really
They boycotted his concert?
Yeah, he had to leave Mexico. So he went to Spain, to Iran, Italy, Germany, and then in Sweden he met his Rosemarie, who is still his wife, and he married her and he stayed there. But he wanted that the first thing for him was to come to United States after he married Rosemarie. He had the plan of coming here, but that was the time of the assassination of Martin Luther King and Robert and Bob Kennedy. So he was black from Cuba, married with this blonde Swedish woman. So he thought maybe it's more prudent mm-hmm. to stay in Sweden than to go to the United States in this moment. So he decided not coming here, who was, for a musician, who was the natural place to be for a musician like Bebo.
One of the things you did for your movie Calle 54, the documentary featuring performances by Latin musicians, was you reunited Bebo Valdez with his son Chucho Valdez, who remained in Cuba and yeah. was pretty popular there. And so they hadn't seen each other much over the years. Were they both amenable to getting together and duetting for your movie?
Yeah, they I think they both need that more than anyone else in the world. For them, it was like an incredible experience. They were in heaven when we were shooting that scene. The fact of being together both in New York and playing together for them was a magical moment, and it was for me and for the movie too. But it was very difficult for Bebo. I remember that he told me once Chucho was playing in Carnegie Hall in New York many years ago, and he hadn't seen him for 17 years. So it was a night that McCoy Tyner was playing and Bill Evans was playing and Chucho was playing with his group Irakere. So Bebo take a plane from Stockholm to New York just to see Chucho, no, in America. But there was, he was never alone. There was a guy from government always with them, no,
because from the Cuban government.
Yeah, always. When they came in tour, musicians, there's always one of the government with them because if not, sometimes people desert. They don't come back when they
defect.
Huh?
Defect.
Exactly. Defect. We say desert or in Spanish. Okay. So at that time, they couldn't speak intimately because there was someone from the government. So that was very frustrating for them.
Huh. Just one more thing. What was Bebo Valdez's reaction when he saw the completed version of Chico and Rita, knowing that this was his final work?
Yeah, it's incredible because I picked up the print when it was finished and I went to Malaga and I rent a theater. And I screened the movie just for him and for Estrella Morente, the flamenco singer, she lives also in Malaga. So it was an incredible experience. I was watching Bebo's face all the time, and he was so moved. And at the end of the movie, he was crying his eyes out with tears, and he kissed me. It was an incredible moment. I will never forget that moment. Very, very emotional and touching for both of us.
Well, Fernando Trueba, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Fernando Trueba speaking with Terry Gross. Trueba co-directed the animated musical Chico and Rita, which is out on DVD next week. Here's a duet with Bebo Valdez and his son Chucho, recorded in 2007. Coming up, David Edelstein reviews the new film, The Master. This is Fresh Air.
As Vietnam War demonstrations in the 1960s and 70s became violent, some questioned protesters' motives.
Are you people just people who have always wanted to throw a rock, so you're just doing it? Or do you have a real idea behind what you're doing?
University Laboratory High School students interviewed 16 local residents about their experiences with counterculture. Listen to their stories the week of September 17th during Morning Edition and Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580.
WILL programs are made possible by Bevere Cafe. Bevere Cafe serves breakfast and lunch from 8 a.m. to 1 p.m. Monday through Friday. Daily menus are available online at bevercafe.illinois.edu. Bevere offers Wi-Fi and is staffed and managed by students. Bevere Hall, corner of Gregory and Goodwin, Urbana.
From events halfway around the globe to right in your backyard, keep up to date on the issues and ideas affecting your life right here every day on AM 580.
The writer-director Paul Thomas Anderson had his breakthrough with the 1997 film Boogie Nights, then went on to direct such acclaimed movies as Magnolia and There Will Be Blood. His latest is The Master, which centers on the relationship between a fringe spiritual leader played by Philip Seymour Hoffman and an unstable disciple played by Joaquin Phoenix. Film critic David Edelstein has a review.
Paul Thomas Anderson's The Master is both feverish and glacial. The vibe is chilly, but the central character is an unholy mess, and his rage saturates every frame. He's a World War II South Pacific vet named Freddie Quell, and played by Joaquin Phoenix to the hilt above the hilt. We meet him at war's end on a tropical beach where he and other soldiers seek sexual relief atop the figure of a woman made out of sand. No, it's not your father's war, at least the war portrayed in most sagas of the so-called greatest generation. Alcoholic, sex-addicted Freddie can't adjust to a society that Anderson portrays as homogenized, repressed. Then he stumbles into something extraordinary, a burgeoning cult called The Cause. The Cause is allegedly modeled on Scientology in the days before its leader, L. Ron Hubbard, rebranded it as a religion. Why allegedly? Anderson won't officially admit the connection, perhaps because the church is so given to suing its critics. Whatever the model, the title character is named Lancaster Dodd and played by Philip Seymour Hoffman as a man with the soul of a child, trying hard to present himself as a Brahmin-like patriarch and visionary. Freddy stows away on Dodd's yacht after fleeing migrant workers who think he poisoned a man with his homemade booze, and he probably did. It's not clear. Rather than chucking Freddy overboard, the master takes a fatherly interest.
Why all the skulking and sneaking? You've wandered from the proper path, haven't you? The problems you have.
I don't have any problems. I don't know what I told you, but if you have work for me to do, I can do it.
You seem so familiar to me.
What do you do?
I am a writer, a doctor, a nuclear physicist, a theoretical philosopher. But above all, I am a man. Hopelessly inquisitive man, just like you.
Paul Thomas Anderson's films, Boogie Nights, Magnolia, even There Will Be Blood, have surrogate families that can be wonderfully attractive to emotional orphans like Freddie. Here, disciples eagerly submit to what's called processing. Dodd asks questions and then repeats them over and over, at once bullying and hypnotic, until his subjects break and open up. Like a Freudian therapist, he targets past traumas, but these traumas supposedly go back to birth, and before that, trillions of years. For Dodd, the body is but a vessel for a kind of Buddhist-like transcendental soul. His processing purges basic emotions he calls animal. On one level, wayward Freddie longs to be led, but something in him resists committing to a man he doesn't fully trust. And so the film becomes a push and pull of titanic wills. Freddie will either be subjugated or flee to a life of debauchery, and likely drink himself to death. There's no middle ground here. There's no middle ground for Joaquin Phoenix, either. He's both riveting and painful to watch. He also seems to be channeling other actors' tics, Eastwood, Brando, even Robin Williams's Popeye, the words dribbling out the side of his twisted mouth. But his scenes with Hoffman are amazing. Hoffman's Dodd is perfectly nuanced, in the tradition of flim-flam visionaries so in love with their own spiels, they forget their frauds. Like There Will Be Blood, The Master is more austere than Anderson's overflowing ensemble dramas. He shot it on now-rare 65mm film stock, which gives radiant depth to the palette of browns and blacks, while low-angle close-ups make Dodd and Freddie monumental. They're the whole film, really, although Dodd is always surrounded by followers who hang on his words and regard his belligerent media critics as their enemies, too. Amy Adams adds a chill as Dodd's wife, who presses her lips together and exhorts Dodd to attack those enemies before they attack him. Radiohead's Johnny Greenwood has composed a score full of abrasive plinks and discordant horns. It's alienating, like the movie. But The Master captures in a way I've never seen the tension in American culture between stubborn individualism and a desire to be led, even by leaders who are ludicrous. There's no explosive catharsis. The movie is spectacularly unresolved. It leaves you spent, brooding, unlikely to join a cult, but on some level sad that this one's such a crock.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer today is Kevin Griffin, with additional engineering support from Joyce Lieberman and Julian Hertzfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Heidi Simon is doing our online media. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from American Recordings, presenting The Carpenter, the new album from the Avett Brothers featuring Live and Die, available now at Starbucks. From the Wallace Foundation, a source of ideas for expanding learning opportunities beyond the school day, at wallacefoundation.org. And from Chevrolet, maker of the Volt, an electric car that runs on electricity or gas to go farther. Details at ChevyVolt.com. This is NPR.
Programming on WILL is made possible by McKinley Presbyterian Church and Foundation, a vibrant faith community that encourages spiritual exploration and works for social change. McKinley is committed to inclusiveness and welcomes all. 5th and John Streets on campus, on the web at www.mckinley-church.org.
It's 11:59. Stay with us. The Afternoon Magazine is coming up next right here on listener-supported public radio, WILL, 580 AM and 90.9 FM, HD3 Urbana. And among the stories we're following at this hour, University of Illinois trustees have approved a larger budget for the next fiscal year. $5.4 billion spending plan is up by 7.6% from last year. Valparaiso University in Indiana has warned students on its website of increased security after receiving a vague threat through graffiti. It's not clear whether the Valparaiso threat is related in any way to bomb threats today that forced evacuations at the University of Texas and North Dakota State University. A Chicago Public Schools official says she thinks there could be an agreement today to end the teachers' strike that has idled 350,000 students all this week. And Governor Mitch Daniels has named a Tippecanoe County judge as the first woman on the Indiana Supreme Court in 13 years. We'll have details on these and many other stories in the next hour as we provide you an hour of news and information from NPR, the BBC, and Illinois Public Media. Let's update you now on what's happening in the commodity markets, and we'll start with Kansas City wheat.